Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hi, this is Pascal, and today I'm super stoked and excited to be talking to a dear and old friend of mine, Ryan Merkley. Ryan used to be the COO of the Mozilla Foundation, which is where we met when I was also at Mozilla. Later, he became the CEO of Creative Commons, and more recently, he became the chief of staff to the Office of the Executive Director of the Wikimedia Foundation, which of course is the organization behind Wikipedia. And before all of this work in tech, he worked for the city of Toronto and Vancouver. Before we get into it, let me point one thing out. It is Wikipedia's 20th birthday. Happy birthday, Wikipedia! And for all of you to check out what this means in terms of their history and their current work, the wonderful folks over at Wikipedia have put up a beautiful website. You should check it out. It's at 20.wikipedia.org. 20.wikipedia.org. Go there, see the celebration of all of their amazing history and the current work they're doing. And with that being said, let's get into it. Hey, Ryan, it's awesome to have you on this show. And we both go back quite a few years working both at Mozilla, at different parts of the organization, where I was on the commercial side, Mozilla Corporation, and you were on the nonprofit side, the foundation. It is awesome to have you here. I want to kick us off with a question for you, which is, you've been in this field of innovation disruption in the digital space. You also have some interesting backdrop in the public sector. And I want to start off with asking you, what do you think is the difference between innovation and disruption, if there is one?
Well, hello. Thanks for asking me to come on and chat with you. We always have good conversations, so I appreciate the opportunity. The question is, what's the difference between innovation and disruption, if there is one? I guess the piece that I might grab onto for me is that when I hear innovation, I think of, you know, imagining a new approach or a new, bringing something new into the world that has not been before. And that doesn't always have to be the case for me, I think, in disruption, that sometimes the times can change and disruption can happen. So maybe they're not as coupled for me. I think we're used to a definition of disruption that has innovation inside it, that there's a flash moment that someone does a thing or invents something before unthought of that takes you down that path. And I think that's probably fair. But I wonder, and you have a better view into disruption than I do, but I wonder if you can have disruption where the world changes around a thing and it causes that disruption to take place, as opposed to the sort of act of creation that we're so focused on, of the sort of the unicorn disruptor.
Well, arguably, we are living in a world of disruption with the current global pandemic around COVID, of course. I love the distinction you're just drawing out here, which brings up an interesting question, which is, I see so many organizations, particularly, you know, like large corporations, are so fixated on this idea that they want to be the disruptor and they want to disrupt and they don't want to get disrupted. Given your view or your comment you just made, is that even possible?
I was having a conversation with my wife, Kelsey, about the school board. At lots of families, the kids are hopefully going back to school. In some states in the US, they've already started, and lots of places they aren't going back at all, or they're going back online. Where I live in Toronto, Canada, kids are going back to school over the next couple of weeks. And there's a lot of anger on the part of parents because the school boards have not responded well and effectively to what is really a tectonic shift in what they were previously asked to do. And you know, one of the things that I think is interesting is most organizations are lousy at this because they're not designed for rapid adaptive change. They're designed for do one thing very well, ideally with incremental refinement over pick your time period. And that's what organizations tend to be good at. They're set up to do a thing and they're built over time and structured and refined and even either solidified or reinforced or maybe ossified to consistently do that thing and refine it. The idea that we would show up, especially in this pandemic, and I think it was you who first talked about this as an exclamation point market drop, where it's not, you know, the line doesn't slide downwards at any angle. It just drops off a cliff and then maybe a thud at the bottom, which is really what whole parts of the market did in this pandemic moment. It's a lot to ask that anyone can pivot or adapt to that kind of disruption so quickly, let alone an institution like a school board or a government. And so I found that fascinating. Like, it's so uncommon for the world to dramatically change around you in the way that this has, that it has, you know, wiped out whole markets and also created whole markets. I have heard that from a colleague who runs the online store for a bike shop, they're having every single month the best month they've ever had in history. Not in the pandemic, not in the recent memory, in history. They are doing more bike sales today than they've ever done. And their store's closed. And that's, no one saw that coming. And it's just one tiny example, but I think that adaptation to disruption really stands out to me. And the capacity for organizations to do a thing they're not built to do at all. I don't know that you should necessarily build organizations to be able to adapt in this way. I don't know that that's useful. It's like expecting a bomb blast in your parking lot. How much do you want to overbuild an organization to be able to do that when it's so unlikely?
That brings up an interesting question, which is, and I've been pondering about this quite a bit. You said earlier something around that organizations are designed to do one thing and do it really well. The way we phrase this, we talk about organizations being efficient, effective, and optimized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wonder, is there something in the DNA of the organization that you can actually even change in a way that allows you to do the next thing? Or is there just a natural lifespan to an organization, or most organizations at least, which means you do your one thing, you become super efficient, effective, and optimized. And then when the disruption happens, quote unquote, it's time for you to roll over and, you know, let someone else do it.
I mean, I feel like you're leading us back to the question lots of people, or a topic lots of us have been talking about, which is the future of Mozilla. But I always think of the example of the March of Dimes, where, you know, that institution was created with an intention of eradicating polio. And over the period of its time working, eventually more or less did that and reached a point where the organization had to sit down and say, all right, well, we built this thing and it's really good at doing this particular thing. And we've more or less done that. What do we do now? And one completely legitimate answer would have been pack up and go do something else. Close it all down. March of Dimes is over. We've eradicated polio, at least in the developed world, or as they had anticipated. We could be done. They chose not to. They chose to write a new mission and a new focus, and that organization still exists today, but they could have not done that. But it is also hard to give up when you've built something that has power and you have a team that you like and appreciate that works well together, and you have infrastructure that you've constructed. It's hard to let that go. And maybe not a good idea to let that go when you've got talent. You know, I'd be interested in your thoughts too on, you know, Mozilla, you know, the institution that we both worked for. Both feel really strongly about its importance in the world and what it accomplished. You know, that as an organization, Mozilla set out to try and really save the web from a set of structures that were making it lousy and inaccessible for competition, but also bad for users. And now, almost 20 or about 20 years later, you know, Firefox won. It did the thing it was supposed to do. At the time, build an open source browser was the right answer to the question, which is how do you beat a monopoly that is making the web worse? When you create that space for competition, you build something that is feature equivalent but better and that allows other folks in. They did that. Nobody else did that. No one can ever take that away from Mozilla. But that's not the question that is challenging the web today. And so they have a whole new challenge. How do you take this thing that really knows how to build a browser, but doesn't know what the next thing should be? And I think that's a fascinating question. I think we need the values of Mozilla very deeply. I think even Mozilla doesn't yet know what do we need the organization of Mozilla for, and where should it go next? I mean, that's been really tough. And I want to acknowledge that, you know, 250 people lost their jobs over the last couple of weeks as they've done a big round of layoffs. I think 70 more about 6 months before that. It's been a really hard year for those folks. And that's really, you know, challenging. But I also think there's an existential question for Mozilla, the organization, about where is its rightful place in the world as it has accomplished this disruption you've talked about? What is the next one? Does it know what it is? And is it the right organization as it is now? Or can it become the right organization it needs to be for the next one?
So much to unpack, right?
Yeah.
When I think about this particular example, a couple of things come to my mind. So one being Mozilla solved a very acute consumer-facing problem when we originally started out with Firefox, which people actually saw and they felt that the web was in a bad place. Of course, the world of the browser monoculture and Internet Explorer had become very stale. And it was just people wanted to do stuff on the web and they couldn't, or they couldn't do it safely and securely and with trust. I don't know if that's the case today. I see the fight for mobile and the fight for data and so on. And clearly that starts to shift, particularly recently. But for quite a while, when I talked about this, people were like, what do you mean? Facebook is fine. It's totally cool that Google has all my data. And so I think there's an interesting challenge on the consumer side. The other side was, we have this model, and I'm curious what you think about this, but we've got this model at Be Radical where we talk about disruptions being, in most cases, essentially what we call state changes. So if you take water molecules, when they're frozen, they're solid, and then they warm up and they become liquid, and then they warm further and they become gas. And for me, it feels this is like disruption is these phases where the water molecule changes from one state to the other. And a good example for this, of course, if you want to go back in the mother of all disruptions, Blockbuster, you went from stores with VHS videotapes to DVDs being shipped to your house through Netflix, and then ultimately, of course, streaming, which goes straight to your television. And the important point for us is that the underlying need, the consumer need, has never changed. So argument is then to say that it really is in your powers to actually do something about it, because the disruption isn't this fundamental shift, this completely new thing. It is rather a state change, a behavioral change, a desire change, an underlying technology which allows you to do the thing you want to do, the job to be done better using a different piece of technology. And I think that's also something where, when I reflect back on Mozilla, particularly the time when Mozilla mostly stumbled in the mobile world and fell over their own feet a little bit, where they just didn't get that, I think. I'm curious what you think in terms of that model and where that nets out, not just in the case of Mozilla, but with other quote-unquote disruptors.
You know, I think it's interesting that you use the science metaphor of the state change or the physical change, because I often think about, I was listening to a podcast recently that was talking a little bit about the difference between physical change and chemical change, where the matter changes in a way that is irrevocably different. And I think there's something to that as well, that when the, you know, you use the example of Blockbuster, Netflix, streaming, yes, the fundamentally you're still receiving the same content, but also it is a different animal at that point. It has changed. There are things that are different, and sometimes irrevocably so, whether it's about the quality of the content that comes through, whether it's about the degree to which you own what you have purchased. And so it is a fundamental different relationship to the product, or the consumer experience is different. For example, there's never ads anymore in content that I receive. And so there are state changes. So it's still a movie. It's a movie on the screen. It came through the pipe versus off a disc. That I would call that a state change. But there's also a chemical change, which is it's not the same movie anymore. And it feels different. And my relationship to it is different. And I think one of the mistakes we sometimes make is to assume that it's only the state change piece, because I think there are relational changes that happen to the things that we experience and the things we buy that I think are relevant. So I say that not to disagree with your theory, but to say that I think there are also modifiers maybe that are worth thinking about.
I love the notion you just brought up. I'm curious, how do you think this plays out in the world of an organization with their products and or services?
I think the part that I grab onto or that I want to think is relevant or useful is understanding the things that are lost and gained or added or subtracted, maybe, when you think about how that state change took place and or what it feels like in that new environment. So you've gone through that disruption. What have you gained through that process? So I'll use an example from my current work. So once upon a time, we got generic subject-based knowledge from encyclopedia. And now we get that subject-based knowledge from Wikipedia. And that's sort of the main standard by which whole parts of the world gather that information. And there's a huge market disruption there to the degree that encyclopedia were a market. That's one of my favorite quotes from Douglas Copeland, who wrote Generation X. Someone asked him, what do you think about the internet? And his answer was, if I made encyclopedias, I'd be scared shitless right now. And that was 30 years ago that he said that. And, you know, he was right, I guess, although maybe not the most macroeconomic comment to offer, but in my world, that's a pretty interesting quote to have in my pocket. So the state change is there. The knowledge is now delivered through Wikipedia or through one of the various wiki projects, and it gets to people all over the world. But there's also fundamental changes in the way the thing exists now. It's faster than it ever was before. So it has velocity in a way that encyclopedia did not. Its authorship is dramatically different. It used to be encyclopedias were written by a very small number of folks. Now it's written by tens of thousands of people and sometimes arguing with each other over a single edit. And it's no longer constrained by volume. And so the article about anything can be as long as it needs to be. And it used to be that every subject would fight for column inches inside a volume of encyclopedia that could not be more than X number of books. And so those constraints are gone. And so you have velocity, authorship, and volume, which are three huge factors that have changed the thing. And so, yes, the state of it has changed, but also its elements and features have so dramatically changed as to be, it is not the same thing at all anymore. And I think that's interesting because failing to understand that, and you can miss key features of the product. Some of those things that I've described are things users feel, like the depth and length of an article is a thing users feel every day because they get lots of information if they want it. Authorship is not a thing that users feel. When they go to read the article about Chadwick Boseman, they don't think about, by and large, who wrote the article in the same way that they didn't think about who wrote the encyclopedia article. And so that users don't feel that every day. But a set of users feel it when they become editors and know that they can correct anything that they think is inaccurate or not well written and have that opportunity. So I like that filter as not just thinking about the ways in which that thing has become more efficient or delivered in a new way, but also the way that change in delivery or method or product has come with new features or constraints that didn't exist before.
Do you think you can anticipate those constraints and additional features? And if so, can you anticipate them before you can actually define the product? Can you define where these constraints and additional features might lie and then work backwards what the service and product needs to look like? Can you conceptually understand what the future of encyclopedias might look like and then reverse engineer Wikipedia out of it? Or can you only see it in hindsight?
I feel like the right answer is yes, and I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, there's a version of that answer to me that feels like, of course you could do that. Of course you could lock yourself and a bunch of other smart folks in a room with some whiteboards. Remember when we were allowed to stand together in front of whiteboards? And you could play if this, then that on whole components of this. And based in a world that we knew, there are versions of this that I feel like I could predict. But I also have to remember that these things are happening in a world of three-dimensional chess where this is not if this, then that. This is 1,000 games of if this, then that happening concurrently. So you have to, I mean, this is what you do for breakfast, but this is plotting all the different things that are moving at one time makes it pretty hard to predict what's going to happen. So there's a version of me that thinks, yes, you should probably do parts of this. And then there's a version of me that thinks, I suspect that if I could confidently say yes to that, I'd make a lot more money than I do right now doing something else. Probably answering that question.
Right, exactly. You know, one thing which fascinates me when I think about particular Wikipedia is this interesting shift from, in the old world, we seeked out information and it was attached to quite a bit of effort. When I take Encyclopedia Britannica, I need to pull it out of a shelf. I need to first have it, and then I need to pull it out of a shelf and look up and so on. And then, of course, we went into the world of the internet and I get Wikipedia and I can just type it in. And what really struck me the other day was I was reading a book on Kindle and there was a word I wasn't familiar with, and you log tap it and it pulls up the definition. And it really struck me how the world of information retrieval and knowledge has suddenly become this really in the moment, and to a certain extent, even proactively pushing it into you, which then made me think that this must change. If this becomes the norm, it very fundamentally changes the way we think about knowledge. And thus also, of course, we think about a product like Wikipedia. How do you think about this? You must think about this a lot, because yeah. Wikipedia is so much more than just a website these days.
I'm enjoying where this is going. There's a piece of this that is, I think we take for granted the longevity of the materials that we read as knowledge. You don't have to go back that far, let's say 30 years, to when the newspaper was the thing that you read physically and then threw away. And then after that, that article or those articles that were written for that day and read by only the people who had a copy in their hands at some point were only able to be accessed by microfiche in a library if they had it. And those are the two ways people read a newspaper article: the day it came out, maybe the day after, and much later in a library collection. And now those articles are read everywhere all the time, years later, cited in Wikipedia, archived in the Internet Archive, and available usually in real time at your fingertips, probably forever. That was not always the case. That is true for newspaper articles, magazine articles, whole parts of television that is now produced, which used to be ethereal and then gone. You had to watch things live. Radio, all of those things are now things that we can pull up on demand whenever we want later in many instances. That was not true 20 years ago. We think about that because it is those things that become citations that live one step below every single fact that you find on Wikipedia. There is an article somewhere. And it used to be that those things were only encyclopedia and books or a microfiche archive. And that is not the case at all anymore. Now that complete compendium of material is just as readily available from your phone to almost anyone with a bandwidth connection anywhere in the world in real time.
Your business model today largely is, of course, donations. And if you've used Wikipedia, you know that you do your very successful donation drive, your pledge drive, mm-hmm. on your webpage. Now, I consume quite a bit of Wikipedia, and I know a lot of people consume, particularly younger people, consume a lot of Wikipedia through places like our good old friend Alexa, and mm-hmm. where I just ask Alexa something, and Alexa magically knows the answer, and it only knows the answer because you were so kind to feed it your knowledge into it.
We're doing Alexa's homework for her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
But it also means that Alexa doesn't ask me to donate to the Wikipedia Foundation. And mm-hmm. what that brought up for me the other day, as I was thinking about this, as I saw your recent pledge drive, I was thinking, wow, you're going through the same kind of disruption of essentially the demonetization aspect of a business, which, you know, many big businesses go through as more and more stuff gets cheaper and eventually becomes demonetized. Somehow it feels like you guys are also getting demonetized because you lose that ability to talk to the consumer and say, hey, you get value out of what we're doing here and please give us some money. How do you think about this? How do you deal with that?
I think it would be fascinating if, or fabulous actually, if Alexa wanted to just pop in and ask if folks wanted to make a donation to Wikipedia from time to time. I think that's probably not going to happen, but there's a version of that answer that is enormous, well-funded corporations that are benefiting from the free labor of hundreds of thousands of editors from around the world are getting a free ride and should directly, substantially, to the tune of Wikipedia should have $1 billion endowment, kind of substantially, support that work to find some way to return the value that they have accrued on behalf of or from volunteers. That's one end of the conversation. And at the other end of the conversation is, this is the great success of free knowledge. This is what was designed to happen, that a group of volunteers would come forward and build something that was explicitly designed to be reused commercially. It was. Without going down the licensing rabbit hole, the content that you find on Wikipedia has a what's called an open license on it, which means that you are allowed to reuse that work so long as you meet the terms of the license. And the majority of the content on that license is CC BY SA, or Creative Commons for attribution share alike, which means you can use the work so long as you credit the source, link back to it, and link to the license so other people know what the license is. And if you make something new with that work, you have to apply the same license to it. All that is to say, the folks who created this project almost 20 years ago wanted the content to be used in Alexa and in the sidebar of Google search results and a million other places we never even thought possible. That's success. When you get the information that you want, wherever you need it, that's us winning at our mission, which is you getting free knowledge as you need it, where you need it. There are really good questions to ask about how those companies, mostly, who benefit from that, give back to the communities that have done that work and helped them, and also how they give credit to those folks, so that you know that when Alexa answers that question, it was Wikipedians who did her homework for her. I think they should be given credit for that, and you should know that the answer to that question was from Wikipedia when it's from Alexa or Siri or Google. And we've worked with those partners to help make that happen more effectively. And they've been responsive, and we work with them regularly.
So would you say that due to the specific nature of the Wikimedia Foundation being a nonprofit and having a mission-driven perspective, it really doesn't affect you all that much? Clearly, you need to figure out how to keep the lights on and pay and build your upgrades, etc. Versus, you know, when I look at business, that demonetization is probably the biggest fear a lot of businesses I talk to have. And as you know, we are in the executive education space. And I want to say that COVID has pushed our space towards probably the inevitable, likely the inevitable, but it has pushed the space 5 to 10 years earlier into that fold, which is massive amounts of demonetization. Because content becomes free and you don't pay as much for an online experience, etc. And I think it's a really hard thing for people to wrap their heads around. I'm curious, with your specific perspective, not taking into account, of course, that you work at a mission-driven organization where winning might look very, very different. How do you perceive this? Is there anything you have where you say, this is how I think about this? This is how I would answer someone who comes to me and says, Ryan, that is easy for you to say, but the livelihood of my business hangs in the air due to the fact that everything gets free.
I mean, everything was free for us from the beginning. And so value was never about monetization. There's been a number of studies that have tried to put a value on the commons or on Wikipedia, despite the fact that everything that you will ever find on Wikipedia is free to use and reuse. You know, 11 plus million people a year make a donation because what they find there, they value. And so it may be demonetized, but it's not devalued. And I think that's a distinction that we get to make because we are a public good not a public company. And so we don't have to accrue that corporate value. We have to fulfill our mission. We run on an assumption that has been an assumption that has held true for two decades now, that if we provide people value and we can find ways to help them answer the questions that are before them by putting free knowledge in their hands as they need it, that when we ask them for their support, that enough of them will come forward to cover the costs of doing the work that we all want to do together. And it's not just the 500 folks who work for the foundation that support the broader community, but there are people in communities around the world who both work as volunteers and also in chapters as staff. Somebody in our Slack channel today said that, quote, Wikimedia is like a unicorn scale product organization, but instead of 15,000 running it, you have 500. We're a top 10 website, which only has 500 full-time employees, who gets over 700 million views a day. And I talked about, you know, record sales in the bike shop. We're also seeing record traffic on Wikipedia in this moment, some of the highest traffic we have on record. So more and more people are coming looking for answers. And it's not just on COVID stuff, though the COVID content is getting a ton of traffic. And there are dedicated volunteer communities working on that day in and day out. But it's across the board that people in this new dynamic are coming to us looking for answers to whatever it is they're trying to learn about.
Something you just said really got me thinking. You were talking about you've got 11.5 million users who go on your website and donate, clearly valuing the work you do and the work the community does and the content you create and put out there. There's a train of thought in the community around when we talk about demonetization and the inevitability of it, where we talk about probably we need to get away from a profit maximization and we go into value capture. So you basically say, so we are driving the value and thus the community, the users will ultimately pay for it. And the example I like to use is we run a few of our things as a pay what you want, online courses or events. And it works actually pretty beautifully for us, mostly as a way for people to show appreciation. And then there's, of course, the very famous case of, I believe it was Coldplay. They put out an album where they basically said you can get the album online.
It was Radiohead, and the album was called Rainbows.
Radiohead and Rainbows. You definitely know your musical references better than I do. But they made quite a bit of money on this, where the community truly valued. Which brings up an interesting question, which is, notwithstanding what you think the overall value of Wikipedia is, which clearly is ginormous, but what do you think is the percentage of value you capture from your users?
I mean, I don't have the number in front of me, but I could pull for you the average donation, but then I'd have to cross that against the total number of users. Because, of course, it is a small percentage of users who pay for everyone. But what they, quote unquote, buy for themselves, they actually gift to the world. But there's another piece of it, and I'm going to pivot your question a little, but one of the things we care about, I would even argue that we care about more than how much people choose to donate, though we're incredibly grateful for the fact that people choose to do that because it allows us to keep the lights on. We also really care about how many people choose to contribute. And there's a reason that there's an edit button on every article is because we want people to see this as our collective act, not a product made for them. It's a thing that if it's not good enough, you can make it better. If it's wrong, you can make it right. It's intended to be so, and we want everyone to see it as not just a thing they use, but a thing that they can contribute to. And so we care a lot, not just about the 11 plus million folks who donate, but also the 250,000 people a month who edit and the thousands of people who help support the communities around the world. Those people are super important because there is no project without them. And so we care a lot about that value. And if I was going to be talking about value capture, I think the value of labor is perhaps more important to me, of getting people to feel like they want to contribute. There's a great quote in the documentary about the 1992 presidential election where James Carville, who's a political operative, says, after your love, the greatest thing you can give is your labor. And I think that's true. And money doesn't even make that list in that example. So I think we care more about people's love and their labor but we're grateful for their money because it helps us keep the lights on and support those people who give their labor. While we were chatting, I looked up how much money Radiohead made off of the album In Rainbows. The average donation was a little over $2 per person who paid for the download.
But then they had more downloads than they would have sold albums or something, right? I remember that they considered it financially success, ultimately.
It was financially successful. It's probably not the most money that they ever made. And the best evidence that it wasn't the model they wanted is that they never did it again.
Fair enough. Something you just said, I find really fascinating, which is the value of the labor. And it makes me think, and I leave that to the listener here, if there is a set, at least a subset of business models in the future where you actually create these hybrids where you create value through the monetary component, but you create a lot of value through the quote unquote, the labor, the love of the user. I can envision a bunch of business models which are shifting and changing and tilting, going full circle back to the education piece. I'm thinking Khan Academy, for example, where a lot of people actually contribute to the knowledge in Khan Academy as teachers. So it's not just Khan himself anymore, of course, and essentially create this incredibly rich ecosystem and ultimately very successful company. I think really interesting to think about how can you create business models where the profit maximization is a thing of the past and it becomes a much more complex and intricate level of multiple levers you're pulling instead of just a single number you look at on the balance sheet.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks make assumptions about motivation and the value people want to receive in exchange for their labor or their creativity. When I was at Creative Commons, where I was CEO for 5 years, not a week would go by that somebody wouldn't pitch me an idea to help creators monetize the works that they had chosen to share. And I understand why people were interested in that. And we heard often from creators who wanted to find a way to make a livelihood from their work, but also often the reason people give is not that they secretly wish to be paid. Often it's that they want other value to come from it. I think people contribute to Wikipedia not because they want someone to pay them for that work. And you're not saying that, but I think I've certainly seen the pitches of people talking about how we could help people monetize their contributions. I don't think people want that. I think they give to this thing because they're trying to build something bigger than themselves. And because they believe in the idea that I give a little bit and so does everyone else, we all get something better together. There aren't a lot of those projects in the world. I understand that. I mean, we've devalued the work of government so greatly, even though it is an enormous collective action that we all pay for and all derive value from. But the idea behind Wikipedia and many other open source projects is that if we each contribute, we can all have something great that we all benefit from. And that's the value. Maybe monetization is the answer. And in some cases, I totally understand why that would be. But I think the motivations that live in the minds and hearts of users are often much more complex than that. And when we treat them like they only want monetization, I think we make things that are simple and boring. And when we try and figure out what's in their hearts, I think we make things that are much more compelling and that are stickier and have greater potential.
I want to end on this because that's the perfect ending line, and I could not agree more. Ryan, thank you so much for spending time with me and with us. This was super, super fun. Thank you.
This is a treat. Thanks so much for asking me.
Hey, everybody, that was it for today. Do check out all the tools and frameworks and all the other information we have on our website, beradicalgroup.com. And this is Pascal Finette. Until the next time.